This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Ian Quinn. How are you, Ian?
Oh, good, thanks.
We are here, and normally I'd say sunny Hawke's Bay, but it's murky Hawke's Bay today. I'm quite relieved, actually, and my suntan is working quite nicely. I've done the proper New Zealand thing. I've been sitting out in the sun, and now I'm going to, when I get to Christchurch, I'm going to go do a mole map.
Yeah, we've had quite a warm, very, very warm spring, and I think we're going back into another warm phase at the moment. So yeah. The occasional bit of cloud and a bit cooler is definitely appreciated.
You might hear in the background as we're talking, you'll hear the odd bang going off. It's not people shooting bunny rabbits. It's autumn, really, and the birds are just keen to get into the fruit.
Yeah, we're just at that stage where everything's getting riper and we need to keep it away from the birds.
Yeah, but it is a biological thing. You know, the grapes grow so that the birds eat them.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
The grapes really want the birds to eat them, and the birds really want to eat the grapes. Yeah. It's a bit mean, really. Right, what I want to talk about today is, let's talk a wee bit about your business here in Two Terraces. We'll unpick what your business is and how it works. But Ian, when did you guys start Two Terraces?
We bought the land in 2015. I guess if you took a step back from there, I used to work in telecommunications and I've been doing that for 25 years. Started doing a certificate in wine through a local tertiary organisation as a way to get my mind off the work, and sort of decided once I was sort of exposed to the wine world that I'd really like to do a second career and do something else with the second half of my working life. So at that stage we were living in Hong Kong.
This is you and
Linda.
Linda, your wife.
Yep. Yes, yeah, so Linda and I were living up in Hong Kong, decided to come back and plant a vineyard. And so bought the land in 2015, planted 10 hectares in 2016, another 10 in 2018. The idea behind that size was it was big enough that we didn't need permanent staff. We can farm it with a single tractor and a single operator.
Who's the operator?
Myself. But it also kind of shapes the way the business works because although we have enough economy of scale to work on it full time, it does mean that we can't compete with growers that are sort of 80, 100 or hundreds of hectares in scale.
So a lot of people normally when they go, oh, I'm going to get into the wine trade, the first thing they do is I'm going to create this brand and I'm going to make wine, I'm going to sell it to the world and they're going to beat a path to my door. You've gone down the contract growing, which is a little bit different. Why did you go down that route as opposed to maybe becoming a wine producer?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think getting into the wine industry has always got a certain amount of financial risk with it. And I guess in terms of planting a vineyard and growing, at least you've got that security of owning the land. You know, you're not sort of putting all of your work and investment into a brand. So we always figured we had the land to fall back on. And also, if you go really far back, you know, back to my childhood, when I was growing up, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a park ranger. We used to do a lot of tramping or hiking in New Zealand. So being a national park ranger had an appeal as a 7 or 8 year old. Did a lot of gardening and horticulture at school, so farming was sort of quite of interest. It was around the era also that things like the Apple II and personal computers started coming out, and I got hooked on the technology cycle instead. So I spent 25 years doing that in the networking and telecommunications space, and so it's kind of ironic that as a second career you come back to one of those things that was sort of implanted in you as a kid almost.
Yeah, I know, I'm the same actually. I'm an electrical engineer, but power systems, high voltage stuff.
Right.
But I've always liked education. And so it's strange enough, I left electrical engineering and my wine business is an educational business now. So we're back, yep. You know, you go back to that same sort of thing really, isn't it?
I've always enjoyed learning new things. And one of the things that was attractive about viticulture was I could easily see 20 years of trying stuff and learning new things. Yeah. It's not a static environment at all. So if you like learning, then it's ideal.
Yeah, that's my bus. I always like learning new things. Sometimes I don't even care what it is I'm learning. As long as it's something new and I'm playing around with it, you know, it's good fun.
Yep.
That's half the fun really, isn't it? Just the learning process.
Yeah.
We're actually in Hawke's Bay, and Hawke's Bay's got Napier, and there's a lot of Art Deco around. I spent a lot of time last night looking at Jacob's Ladders. Do you know what that is?
Oh, no.
It's cool. It's right out of Frankenstein. You get two wires that come up, and you have a spark, high voltage spark, sparking between the two, and it goes woof.
Right.
Woof. And it's art. It works Art Deco. I'm that close to building one when I get home. You know, I've just got to worry about it because you have to have 30,000 volts to do it, and it's a bit of a fire risk. But
yeah, I think Napier has the real Art Deco theme to it.
Yeah, and, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of that came from the 1931 earthquake.
Yeah.
A lot of the town was rebuilt in that Art Deco style.
Yeah, I'm loving it. I did think I was into steampunk, now I'm into deco punk. Okay, let's get back to where we're talking about with the wine. Sorry about that, a little bit of a sidetrack there. So you guys set yourself up as contract growers. You're growing a number of different grape varieties. We'll talk about Albarino in depth later on. One of the grapes, apart from Albarino, I'm sort of been interested in is Chenin Blanc from Hawke's Bay. You've got a little bit of that planted here. What attracted you to Chenin Blanc?
I guess when we chose varieties to plant. So we picked Chardonnay because it's something we're passionate about, love Chardonnay, and it's a well-known sub-region for growing good Chardonnay with the diurnal shift and freshness. We planted a little bit of Syrah, again, because we loved it. And then the Gamay and the Chenin we planted, not because we had drunk a lot of it. It was actually more because the people that we wanted to work with were keen on getting a source of those two varieties. With Chenin's had its heyday in terms of volume in New Zealand probably back in the 70s and 80s, and it's really declined, partly as a lot of the New Zealand industry has gone to Sauv Blanc, and yeah, Chenin, a lot of the old Chenin was sort of really overcropped and pretty bland. So what we're left with in New Zealand now is people that are growing Chenin are passionate about it, and it's really being targeted at premium quality end of the market.
One of the Chenins I had in Gisborne was with Kirsten from Mataferro. I think I upset her a little bit because she makes her Chenin in her state range on her ladder, hierarchy ladder, and it's basically an unadulterated Chenin. It's just basically, you know, ferment it and stick it in a bottle type of thing. And I told her I was a little bit disappointed, not because the Chenin wasn't very nice, but I thought it had so much more potential to be fiddled around with and just develop layers that you can do with Chenin. And the climate seemed really nice for Chenin. It's like, it's right, you know, if you think about it, you've got Loire Valley Vouvray, and then you've got sort of, I don't know, Stellenbosch or Paarl, or any of those sort of South African, and you're right in that middle of that climatic range. So I would have thought Chenin would be and it holds onto its acidity beautifully, you know. It's susceptible to botrytis, so it may be not be a good thing for you guys or not, I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely holds its acidity. I guess its weakness is big bunches. So,
but when you say big, you mean big, dense bunches, so you get mildewed problems.
Yeah, as it gets riper, sort of really don't want too much rain. Don't want the berries to swell up and bring in that risk of botrytis. So most years we don't have too much of an issue, but it's something we've got to keep an eye on. In terms of winemaking, we've got quite a few different approaches in terms of what people are fermenting in. So Gordon Russell was the winemaker at Esk Valley.
Yeah,
he left there a couple of years ago. We'd made a few Chenins under the Esk label with him, but really we're still searching for the perfect season, perfect fruit. You probably never get it, but we definitely had unfinished business. So we worked with Gordon. Gordon's daughter is part of a collaboration called Three Fates, and had another crack at it in 24 and 25. So Gordon's approach is very much around large, we call them punch-ins, but sort of 500 litre neutral-like, with a lot of lees stirring to kind of build texture. Other people, Easttopes, have been making Chenin with us since 2018. They've used a combination of eggs and, again, also older...
amphora clay eggs?
Actually, concrete eggs. And also now more that sort of neutral oak, big format, 500-litre puncheons. Amwa's, Amy Farnsworth, is doing Shinan and amphora. So a mixture of amphora and barrels. And then kind of bringing that together to create that complexity as well.
We were talking to a fellow called Brent Lim a couple of days ago, and he was talking about Gamay, you know, because Hawke's Bay is known for Syrah and Merlot-dominated Bordeaux blends. And he was saying that as people are moving away from reds to more white-dominated at the moment, that one of the opportunities is to make a lighter style of red. Is that why you put Gamay in there, or was it a client wanted Gamay and you thought, oh, I'll give them Gamay?
More someone that we wanted to work with that was after Gamay. Yeah, so we ended up planting that, and Rod and Emma Easthope also put their hands up as well. Yeah, sort of back around 2016 or so, we could see a lot of interest in from sommeliers and Gamay as an alternate variety, different story to tell.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was that kind of combination of what we could see in the market and the winemakers that we wanted to work with.
And the guys who are making Gamay for you, are they going down the carbonic maceration style of sort of entry-level Beaujolais, or are they making more of a cru style with maybe partial carbonic or even just normal fermentation?
Combination of different approaches. We've got one winemaker, Organized Chaos, which is very carbonic-centric. It's really interesting sort of seeing a fruit go into tanks, sit for 6-7 days, and then they go to press it off. And Hayden always says it's one of the favourite days in the winery when they get all those aromas through that pressing process.
Do you get all the banana and all the candied fruit?
Yeah, definitely a real confectionery aromas. And that sort of settles down with once it goes through fermentation and with a bit of age. But then we also have other people. Easthopes are really chasing a more serious cru style Gamay. Amwa's, again, is doing Gamay and amphoras, and both Amwa's and Easthopes sort of play with a fair bit of whole bunch just to build some of that complexity and a more serious element to it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, all of those wines, I think, if they're chilled a little bit over summer, they're great drinking, and it's kind of slightly chilled red market is something that people are trending towards.
Yeah, the other great variety you can do that with is Pinot Noir. I understand you've got a little bit of Pinot Noir. I wouldn't have thought Hawke's Bay is a big Pinot Noir area, but what's the story there?
Yeah, there are a couple of producers doing, well, several producers doing really good Pinot, but ours wasn't intentional. When we planted every variety we have here, we have at least two different selections. The idea there was to be able to help winemakers build complexity in their wine. When it came to selecting Gamay, there was only one commercially available selection, a French one called 509. So we ordered that, and then we were looking around for options to get a second selection from somewhere. And we were really fortunate. There was a vineyard down in South Island that allowed us to take some cuttings from their vineyard. Yeah, so we planted those out. We had, a couple of years ago, an amplerographer, someone that specialises in identifying...
Do you know, I was trying to remember the name of that about a month ago, and I just could not remember the name. Amplerographer?
Amplerographer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Guy came out from France to certify the 509 as true to type. Happened to see the other selection that we had there and said, oh, I don't think that's Gamay, and it actually, DNA testing turned out to be Pinot Noir.
How much Pinot Noir have you got that you thought was Gamay?
Probably it's less than a hectare.
Okay.
And I think the way it's evolved, it's an interesting story, and people love the wine, even though they know some of it's Pinot now, so the winemakers are carrying on with it. I guess in retrospect, we probably should have twigged a bit earlier, in the sense that they had two selections grow quite differently. One's very upright. And in the winery, the Gamay is quite often really light and lifted. And the thing we liked about the second selection, which turned out to be Pinot, was it sort of had a darker, broodier drive to it. And you put those two together and you get that complexity, both the lifted floral elements of, say, some of the lighter crews and powerful component that's maybe, you know, Morgon or some of those more intense crews.
Okay. It's interesting you say that. I mean, if you look at Gamay and Pinot Noir and even Grenache, and you go, okay, they're all got that red fruits, they're all produced light styles of wines. Grenache obviously has different alcohol and acidity structure to it, but Gamay and Pinot Noir, even though Beaujolais is, they always try to pretend Burgundy is all about Pinot Noir, Beaujolais is technically part of Burgundy. It's a dirty little secret the French don't like to admit.
Yeah.
that the famous Burgundy is actually a lot of Gamay in there. And if you include all the Nouveau, probably a big percentage of it is Gamay.
Yeah, I like the way the Estopes talk about it. I'm just reading off the back of the bottle. In 1395, Philippe the Bold banished the Gamay variety from Burgundy in favour of Pinot Noir. For the next 600 years, Gamay languished in the shadow of Pinot Noir. Not anymore. Part of the story around them continuing to put the two together in the same wine.
Nice. Okay, Ian, I think we'll wrap it up there. That was really interesting talking about where you're coming from and also some of the unusual grape varieties. I think next week I want to talk a bit about the different clones of Chardonnay.
Great. Thanks, Chris. It's really been really good to have you here.